possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
June 30th is our deadline to raise the funds needed for next fiscal year's programs on WILL Radio. Your support has been terrific, but we are still $80,000 short of our fiscal year-end goal. If you've not made a contribution, please help us close our listener support gap. Give us a call, 217-244-9455, or contribute online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Thanks. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. The Ninth Letter is the literary magazine and website published by the University of Illinois. Both feature poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. And the latest print version of the Ninth Letter, the magazine, is just out. The magazine is published biannually in May and December. The first magazine was published in the spring of 2004. On the program today, we'll talk about the latest edition of the magazine. Our guests are three of the magazine's editors: editor Jody Stanley, fiction editor and writer Philip Graham, and poetry editor and poet Michael Madonick. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. We look forward to your joining the discussion this afternoon. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Well, it's good to see you back together here. It's been over a year. Congratulations on the latest effort. You know, a couple weeks ago, maybe it was not even that, Philip rushed to the radio station, ran up the stairs, and presented us with
the latest issue.
Yeah. And he opened it and breathlessly said, "Look at this, and look at this, and look at this."
Like a little kid.
Yeah. And, you know, with that in mind, I thought it might be fun to ask each one of you to briefly point to something within the magazine that when you first show it to a friend, you know, you go, you got to see this.
I know what Jody's going to say.
No, you don't.
I don't? I like that. Well, maybe I don't. Let me see if I'm right.
I don't know what I point to something different every time, I think, is the problem. The first piece in the issue, the first layout, which is an essay by Steve Almond, is one of the most, I think, one of the most dramatic layouts, and also a very funny piece. But then some of the fiction pieces, the layouts, again, are just stunning. And, of course, there's the insert, the trick pony of this edition, which the magazine falls open to, so that's what most people get to first. I don't know if that's that because that's a poetry feature. I don't know if that's what Mike turns to first or not.
Well, it depends who I'm seeing. If it's my mother, I go to the back page because I wrote the afterword. she's more pleased to see me. But on the poetry side, there are many wonderful things in here, so I'm very pleased. The Barrett piece, of course, I think turned out spectacularly, and it's interesting piece, and the poetry, I think, in general, for my purposes, has there's a good range of technique being displayed, I think, in the work, and that makes me happy.
Well, tell us, just describe, we'll come back to this, but describe briefly for our listeners who haven't had the good fortune yet to pick up the Ninth Letter, describe what this trick pony is.
Well, it's as it came to us, it was described as an installation piece. And when it first arrived, we actually had to cut it into sections and assemble it in a kind of mapped order. And we put it up on a bulletin board and were observing it, I would think, probably for a couple of months before we actually decided that we were going to take it. But the thing about it is that there's a sense of almost being interactive with the piece. And as you were saying before we came on, that you're kind of toying with reading it in different ways. And I think Barrett is interested in the visual arts. So here we have a combination of the visual arts and the writing and the poetry itself. And he's the size of each section pretty much approximates almost a postcard. So you're looking at each one of those. So on the back side of this, let's call it a poster or a map, you're seeing sections of maps, which is speaks to some of the themes in the piece.
Yeah. You know, it's so really fun to play with it. I cut it out of the magazine, and then I could take it around with me, you know, various places. I could take it outside onto the front porch and sit there and read it there and play with it. And it's poetry, a poster, postcard. It's a lot of fun.
And it folds out like a map, too. Like, you know, the maps that you get that are too big when you're driving across country and it's impossible to put them back together again.
Yes, I've almost got it down how it goes.
Just like a map.
Okay, Philip, your turn.
Well, what I thought Jody was going to say was a piece by Tom Franklin, Smunk Gets Out Alive, which is an excerpt from a forthcoming novel, and it's kind of an over-the-top kind of version of a Western. It's sort of really out there and a kind of a parody as well. It's sort of a loving parody of what Westerns do. And actually, it was Jody's idea, because of the style of the piece, that we have sort of a cartoon version of it of some sort. And somebody actually who is a am I getting that right?
Yes. He's an alum.
Yeah, Jay Ryan is an alum of University of Illinois who does a lot of posters for rock and roll concerts and other things of that sort. He not only did the illustration for this, which spreads out over three pages, but he did a handwritten version of the text. So it's not printed. It's actually written. And it looks fabulous. But my piece that I tend to go to, and I go to practically everything that everybody already mentioned, but one of my favorite things is at the end of a piece called Child Born with Wings is a faux carnival poster called The Most Marvelous and Strange Creature Alive, The Astounding Winged Wild Child. And it looks like a carnival poster from about a century ago. And the thing that I love about it is not only the photograph here of this poster, which was designed by the wonderful fine arts people who are collaborators with us in this venture. Not only did they do it, but then they took a photograph of it sort of nailed on an old boarded wall. And then on the page it says here, a downloadable PDF of this poster is available at www.ninthletter.com. So if you like the poster, you can actually go to the website and print a copy for yourself.
What was that website again?
Oh, it was www.ninthletter.com.
Okay, because I forget it all the time.
Yeah, I know. We're always reminding you.
Ninthletter.com.
Yeah.
It's catchy.
Yeah, it is.
www.ninthletter.com.
It's the kind of thing that could go through your dreams at night, you know?
Yeah. So tell us about the collaboration. I mean, the people who work on this publication are amazing. There are so many, and I imagine that every piece that's in here wound up on a wall.
Mm-hmm. Yes, actually, that's pretty much literally true. Mm-hmm. The creative writing program, the graduate students in the creative writing program all work with us on the editorial side, both assisting in the selection of the material, doing the proofreading, the copy editing, every aspect from that end. And then in the School of Art and Design, the graduate and undergraduate students over there do the layout under the direction of Nan Gog and Jennifer Gunji and Joseph Squire, are the three faculty members at Art and Design that collaborate with us. And they and their students create the product. So we provide the text, they provide the visual, and I mean, it's what they come up with is stunning.
Yeah. You mentioned the first piece, Jody, the Steve Almond piece. Steve Almond, the author of Candy Freak, was a guest on Focus 580 some time back. A lot of fun, the piece. A lot of fun, Candy Freak. Give us some idea of how that piece came together with the text, and then the artwork.
The text, Steve just sent us the essay, and because of its relationship to Candy Freak, we thought the essay was wonderfully written and funny, and the timing was very good because Candy Freak was just out, and so we thought that it would be good for us and for him both to have this in the magazine. And then we just gave the text to the designers, and then they turned around and they gave us this layout, which is essentially photographs of a living room with sketched in Candy illustrations. And the piece itself is about Steve's experience almost getting on VH1's Totally Obsessed reality show because they wanted him to be obsessed with Candy, as he appears to be in the book, but not as obsessed as the people on Totally Obsessed apparently are with their things, because he wasn't obsessed enough with Candy. They wanted him to have to be rolling in Candy, to be making love to Candy, all of these things. And he said, "I just really like to eat Candy," and that's about it. And so what the designers did was they took that sort of constructed obsession that VH1 was trying to put on Steve, and they interpreted that visually, I think.
Yeah. One of the nice things about this piece for me reading it is that if anybody's out there who watches reality TV or they have a love-hate relationship with it, this is a behind-the-scenes look at what it's like for what is really a deeply constructed TV show that is not as spontaneous as reality shows want you to believe they are. And it's actually kind of frightening, you know, just how much they're manipulating him into doing what they wanted him to do rather than checking out what his own feelings were about presenting himself.
The title is How Reality Television Ate My Life. Invasion of the Red Bull Conquistadors, the melodramatic farce in 12 brief acts. And the thing about this piece was, when I read it, I thought, is it true? Is it fiction?
It is true.
It's true.
And he got cut from the show. So he never actually appeared on Totally Obsessed after all of that, what he went through. But
Well, I asked people, have you heard of a television show called Totally Obsessed? So yes, it's amazing. It's amazing. And I think I've got a weather thing here. Ed Keyser just breezed through the studio. Yes, indeed. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for portions of southern and eastern Illinois and southwestern Indiana, effective this Monday afternoon and evening until 9 o'clock. Hail to 2 inches in diameter, thunderstorm wind gusts to 70 miles per hour, and dangerous lightning are possible in these areas. In the immediate AM 580 severe weather coverage area, the severe thunderstorm watch includes the following counties in Illinois: Champaign, Coles, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, Piatt, and Vermilion. Repeating, a severe thunderstorm watch in effect for portions of southern and eastern Illinois and southwestern Indiana until 9 o'clock this evening. Stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest on the weather. Now, back
was
to
that
ninth
part of
letter.
The reality show?
This is reality radio.
It's real reality, yeah.
Yeah. So, and then the funny thing is, you know, as I had this sort of at my side for the last several days now, the ninth letter, I turned on the TV and there's a reality show that takes place in a funeral home. Family plot.
Whoa.
And I thought,
where will it end?
Maybe Steve Almond is provided me with the straight poop here. Okay, where do we go next?
Oh, well, I don't know. I think we all came with bits and pieces of the magazine we'd like to share with the audience out there. I think, you know, one of the things for me about working on this magazine that I've enjoyed, that I'll always look back on as one of the real pleasures of being part of this, is finding a manuscript you just love. You know, so much comes in, and then there's this magical moment when you read something and you go, not only would I love to be able to accept this, but I can't wait to see it in the magazine. Your mind starts rolling and running, and there's almost nothing like it. You know, when you finally know that this is going to be in the next issue, and I think we all have to, in a sense, fall in love with something before we let it in. We really sometimes it takes a while to fill up an issue because we're very picky, and we really you know, unless I don't want anything in the magazine that's fiction. I know everybody else feels this way, unless I would really be so happy to read it myself if I weren't connected with the magazine. And that's pretty much our aesthetic. So we come in here with just a lot of affection for the stuff that we've accepted. Mm. And we'd like to share some. I don't know who wants to go first.
I can go.
Okay, sure.
I can go first. I think one of the things that I would love to start with, I might read about three poems if that's okay.
Sure.
But one of the things that I would start with is these translations from the Inuit by Howard Norman, which I think are quite wonderful. And his little, I think just his little essay that precedes the poems is very enlightening. So I'd like to, I'll read one of these at least. And the translations are of Lucille Amarack. And the first one is Grudges. My aunt held a grudge. She forgot why. My cousin held a grudge. He forgot why. My father held a grudge. He forgot why. Lots of things happened in the village. Lots of things. People were born. People died. Gulls were everywhere all the time. The beach and the big boulders on the beach stayed put. My cousin living in another village held a grudge. She forgot why. I held a grudge. It was because a seal nabbed a fish right off my line. I don't hold that grudge anymore, but I remember why I once did. My other uncle held a grudge. He forgot why. My other aunt held a grudge. It was against me. I forgot why. One day I walked over to her house and said, "What's the grudge?" "I forgot," she said. "It was fun holding it," she said. "Then it wasn't." We sat down for a meal. That was a while ago. I forgot what we ate. My aunt was in a pretty good mood, though. She laughed a lot. I forgot what over. We don't often find poetry that's quite that point blank.
Right.
So many pieces I wish I could read that I don't think some lovely pieces in here, excellent pieces by Tam, but Jess, that I think are very powerful and good. A fine poem. I think the next one I'd like to read is by Maxine Skates, and it's entitled Bucket. Bucket of ashes, the oak, the maple, heart of the cherry, red grain of the fir, all burned to drift in the bucket I carry. The big dog is in her small box on top of the piano, stray bits of bone, ashes, my father too, among thousands of white markers. My ashes, the mark on my forehead made by the thumb when I kneel by the stove, what I take away, tend, last night's coals left to stand in the rain, nothing tethered now. Char on wind, not the hammered gold leaf or a vest of stars, not Piaf or Schubert or Paul or poor Balthasar, the mule whose sorry life was given only to labor, these ashes, my bucket. Then a little more, let's see, language type poem, which I find kind of interesting. Just two more, I think, I'd like to read from.
Yeah, quit hogging.
I'm going to move quick here. Or maybe just one. Which just be one more?
Sure, no, whatever.
I like this poem quite a bit, and it's entitled The Chance Should Have a Tapping Stick by Daniel Gutstein, and it's in four sections. One, memory's dirty needle doesn't fit and most afflicts. The hear me now drives a chill road through darkening. Never let it be said that fields change. The smallish pumpkins are sunken crowns, the stolid headstones, tablets of law, where the wood gives a deep stand. The spotted deer glance, marbles abound, where the wind's raw palm thumps the season. Two. Out of the limbs the day departs, the house is hat to the hilltop, and the hilltop dons it like nobody's cocked fashion. Leave a light on, will you? is the difference between a house and a headstone, between a stone and a pumpkin, solvent grief. In this memory, the wheat plays tin strings, bodies curl into dizzy riffs, where the grandfather clock still itches to 12. 3. The second hand makes no heavy return. The chant should have a tapping stick. This is not the knock and scurry for the best rag doll. All the panes have been slathered, blanched sideways and drips. The seeing in's been shut of the night, and the moon burns a mean bulb. This is the old rigmarole, the old kickdown, where the collie mix cowers at the shoe of the leg, and the vial has rested the sharp. 4. Squip blackness has slithered into the veins. The call's been made, and the motor's been heard hacking the night's bitter coat. The hear-me-now drives a chill road through stars come out. Let memory's dirty needle at least rouse the body, the curl. Once more, my God, like the best rag doll, the chant should have a tapping stick and a hall of chimes for every heavy return. Okay. I just want to mention that there is a long poem in here that I very much like and everybody on the staff was very enthusiastic about, which is the Rin Williams poem Anniversary. Mm. And I'm just going to not read from it, but mention it.
But it's really great. Yeah. It's
I hope that the audience is getting a sense that you can go and get this magazine.
Yes.
And you can spend a lot of time with it. It will become dog-eared.
Yeah. And I mean, if people have never seen a copy before, we should say that it's about the size of an art catalog. It's a big magazine, you know, and there's lots of design on it and lots of color and so forth. I mean, it's not your ordinary literary magazine. In fact, we don't call it a literary magazine. We call it a literary arts magazine because of this profound collaboration we have with fine arts.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Okay. So a literary arts.
It's like a coffee table book in a way.
Yeah. But it's very portable.
Very, very.
Fits right on your lap. Or on the table.
It's not that heavy.
No, it's not.
No. Yeah. Okay, who's going to go next?
I'll go next.
Okay.
I want to read the opening paragraphs to an essay titled Citizens of Thebes by Carolyn Alessio. Carolyn was a high school instructor in inner city Chicago. She's also an alum of the University of Illinois and a fabulous writer of fiction and nonfiction both. And when we were putting together the nonfiction for this issue, we had pages for one more essay and nothing to fill it. And I was getting very frustrated and anxious as we approached our editorial deadline. Carolyn had been to campus, although I hadn't met her, but had talked to some of the other people on the staff and mentioned that she was working on an essay about her experiences, and they said, well, you should send it. So she did send it, and I had known nothing about the solicitation or the essay or her, so it came into me pretty much blind. From the opening paragraphs, I was just captivated, and I said, "This is it, this is it." And this has become one of my favorite pieces in the magazine. The design that the designers did for it is absolutely stunning and perfect for this essay. And I know she's pleased with it as well. So I'm very happy to have this, and also to have the chance to read some of her work on here. The graffiti of competing gangs covers the alley outside my classroom. Symbols and fonts vary, from pitchforks and crowns to Old English and bubble lettering, but the venue is always the same. The city's cleanup crew, officially called graffiti busters, arrive from time to time brandishing sandblasters on long gray hoses, but mostly the residents are left to care for the vandalism themselves. On the garage wall closest to my window, a rectangular space has been painted over and over again. The garage itself is brown, but the trouble spot is white, a bright separate area that has grown into a kind of tableau. The gangs even seem to respect it, confining their tagging to it for the most part. It is as though they have been offered a space in a community mural or garden, an outdoor dry erase board. While studying Hamlet last winter, I discovered that my high school seniors had never heard of Greek tragedy. We do not yet have a library at my school, so I headed to the internet to download decent versions of Oedipus Rex and Antigone. When we began to discuss the plays, I expected the students to be horrified or even disgusted by Oedipus's unwitting sins. But instead, my second period seminar seemed pensive. Nobody said much, and for a moment I worried the students were not keeping up with the reading. But then Alex spoke up from the back. Why did Oedipus's kids hang around Thebes after everything happened? A few other students nodded. They'd been wondering the same thing. I looked at the Xerox packets out on the desk with their uneven ink and contemplated Alex's question. Well, I said, glancing out at the alley, why would a family stay living in their house after their son or nephew had been killed in their street? It was not a question I had intended to ask, and I wondered briefly if coffee mixed with antidepressants had anything to do with it. I looked at the class sheepishly, hoping they would ignore the question or start chatting, but Lily shot back. They stay because their son or nephew was killed in the street.
Wow. Citizens of Thebes.
Yes. Yes. Okay, my turn. There are so many things I want to read from, and there's so many things maybe I won't read from but mention. A wonderful sequence of very short pieces that we have by the writer Robert Owen Butler called Severance that are built around the idea that after someone has been decapitated, they're conscious for a minute and a half, and that in a heightened state of emotion, we speak at the rate of 160 words per minute. And so these four pieces are about people who have been decapitated, but they it's their very last thoughts, and they're pretty amazing.
240 words.
Yeah, 240 words.
Amazing
a piece.
Words.
Yeah, but the piece I want to read from is again the A Child Born with Wings, and just one section in the middle. This is this story takes place at the turn of the century, and the 19th to the 20th century, and there's been a lot of industrial pollution into the river, and a lot of children have been born strangely, and one of them is a girl who's been born with wings, and she's been kept by these two people who may or may not be her parents. These keepers, a man and a woman, and they keep her in a barn, and they feed her occasionally. She has only two dogs for companion. She knows nothing of the world whatsoever, but she's curious, and she starts digging out underneath from the barn, and she makes it into the courtyard, and there's a big stone fence, so she really doesn't know anything of the world. And then there's one day when she hears the woman, and the woman is singing, but the young girl doesn't have words for what singing is, but she knows that it's a different sound than she's ever heard before, and so she climbs a trellis to find out what that is. And while she's climbing up, the man who she knows has gone out to go hunting, to shoot birds with the dogs, she hears the crack of the gun, and she turns to that sound, and for the first time in her life, she sees the wider world. And this is that moment for someone who hasn't yet learned how to speak. Like a spider, she spreads her limbs, drawing her body closer to the house where she's on the trellis. When she turns her head and sees for the first time beyond the garden wall. Though it will be years before she learns to speak, and years more until she tells another soul what she saw in this moment, what she could never explain is what she felt when the veil of her world was lifted. After all, words are terrible things, awkward and heavy, unsuitable for conveying what moves inside the body. As inadequate as the letters on a jar for describing the sweet nature of strawberry jam. Yet she could say that she saw many other big houses, most of them clustered not far from her garden, and some spread out over the hills, and she saw a vast body of water reaching into the sky, rolling, and where it touched the earth, moving back and forth like the oak branches outside her window. When the wind blew, she smelled the water, or maybe something in the water. Yes, she can taste it now, the water, the something in the water tastes like her skin when the sun burns hot, like the water that flows from her eyes. The water she sees out there is the same as the water inside of her. She wonders how it can be that she is filled with this water, whether she had once lived there, like the white birds she sees floating above the waves. and calm settles over her. She watches the birds and thinks that she belongs with them beyond the wall. Looking behind her, the little girl sees land, so much land that rises and falls like the water, but the land is motionless, still as water in winter, so that people could carve roads into its dry, unmoving waves and build on it big houses with many holes in the walls. And there are many people on the land. Some ride in large boxes with round legs, pulled by enormous dogs, so different from her dogs, pulling their people along the roads that begin where the sky touches the earth. These roads join like the strands of a spider's web, growing denser as they approach the crowded village. She hears the feet of the enormous dogs as they pound the earth, louder in the village center, where the roads are covered with stones. She had heard these sounds before coming over the garden wall, rising and fading like the wind in the trees, and she thought that as birds and insects come in different forms too, so these sounds were another wind. She smiles at her mistaking the footfalls of dogs. Well, it's so wonderful for me. It's, of course, they're not dogs at all. They're horses, but she has no way of knowing that. And one other thing here, when she's looking at the people, she can't believe that, you know, there's food at these stalls. She's looking at a market, and people are walking by it without grabbing the food because she's always starving. And the girl sees all the people, the feeders and the hungry, the hungerless and the little ones. All of them wear clothes that cover their wings, and she wonders why. Why would they hide them? Because at this point she still doesn't know that she's different from everyone else. Mm.
That's from the short story, A Child Born with Wings, Brian Tierney. Mm-hmm. And this is the Afternoon Magazine. We just heard Philip Graham reading from A Child Born with Wings, which is included in the latest ninth letter, the Literary Arts Magazine, published by the University of Illinois. Also with me this afternoon in the studio, the editor for the ninth letter, the editor of the ninth letter, Jody Stanley, and the poetry editor, Michael Madonick. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon if you'd like. If you've got a question, we are happy to hear from you. Questions, comments, they're invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's go back and talk about your friend's contribution to the magazine, Robert Olin.
Oh, Bubba, yes, yeah.
Four pieces of Severance. Very moving, very short stories. Mm-hmm. And from reading in the back of the magazine about the contributors, I learned that this is
an entire book, part of an entire
book.
Yes,
and it also coincides with a ballet.
Yeah. Now that I don't know too much about.
That's something that that we found out shortly before. Mm. I think the magazine went to press, and he had written and asked that that be added to his contributor's note, and so we haven't had a chance to ask him too much about that. It's that's rather interesting to consider, considering that it's based on decapitation.
I don't know how,
how they're going to play that out in dance, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Quickly, I think.
Yeah. About a minute and a half for each dancer.
Yeah. So what would you like to say about Robert Olin Butler? And it seems to me that he's working once again, exploring the short story.
Yeah, very short story in this case. I mean, it's about as short as you can get. It's 240 words. It's about a page, you know, per piece. And I think what is remarkable about these pieces for me is that they're the voices of people under great stress. I mean, they've just been decapitated, and yet they're no one's screaming, "Oh, I'm going to die!" Instead, the brain kind of just moves along and it catches strange memories, and you know, it's this last little bit of consciousness before the lights go out, and so it's a kind of very intense, almost summing up in a strange sort of way, an incomplete, but a summing up in some way of a person's life.
Yeah.
And he ranges from someone who was guillotined during the French Revolutionary Tribunal to a Vietnamese man in the 60s beheaded by North Vietnamese troops, and then a woman beheaded in the collapse of the South Tower of the World Trade Center, and then a civilian truck driver, Tyler Alkins, who was beheaded by a jihadi group in Iraq. And of course, these are all imagined characters. But you could get the sense of the historical range of what he's doing besides sort of the intensity of characterization in each short piece. Yeah.
You want to read one of those?
Oh, my. Okay. Which one do you think?
I like the last one.
The last one? Okay. Yeah, no, okay. Tyler Alkins is a civilian truck driver beheaded by the Iraqi Al-Tawad Wal Jihad Monotheism and Holy Struggle Group, 2004. My name is Tyler Alkins, my voice sounding far off, guttering like the bleeder flames in the refineries outside Houston. My mother's name is Marietta, the red dot on the video camera, the drop of blood at the corner of her mouth. My father's name is Ralph, and the old man is upon me, grabbing at my shoulder. Boy, turn around and take this beating now, he says. But I wrench my mind to him, and me out with shotgun, waiting for the doves to break, and then he squeezes at my shoulder, but gently, the feathers of a dove fluttering still from the air, the kick of the gun shuddering through me, and a hand comes upon my shoulder from behind, and a voice cries, Allahu Akbar, and it is just me and my rig driving the interstate hard at night, the sodium vapor lamps coming up out of the dark like a sky full of nearby stars. I live in Lubbock, Texas, and our own George is the president, and he calls upon all of us, and I can drive a truck, and my old man grabs my shoulder, and I have done something wrong, and he says, in the name of Jesus, and a bite at my neck, Allahu Akbar, and George has prayed to God, and he will kick ass, and plenty of it, and my father cries, take this beating now for your own good.
From Four Pieces of Severance. Jody, this makes me think of something that you note at the outset. A number of the works herein explore the territory of personal identity and the ways we define ourselves and the reality that surround us. Mm-hmm. You want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, it's always interesting to me once an issue has been put together, because when we gather the material, the genre editors, Mike Phillip and Steve Davenport, our nonfiction editor, and myself are generally working independently, getting stories and poetry and essays, and then the artists are working independently as well. And it comes together at the end, and then I have a chance to look over everything, and the number of connections that I find among the various pieces of poetry and fiction and nonfiction, it never ceases to amaze me. It's as if we're working on theme issues almost without intending to, or we're connected on some higher level, which kind of frightens me to think about. But the designers are very good at picking up those threads of themes and making those connections visually, without without being overt about it. But you will see similarities. Connections throughout the designs of various pieces that make this issue and the previous issues complete discrete objects, rather than just random pieces thrown together between pages and bound up with glue. I think that in this issue, especially in the in pieces of fiction and nonfiction like A Child Born with Wings, like the Robert Owen Butler pieces and Carolyn Alessio's piece, and another essay that we have by John Horgan, a science writer who's writing about the effects of LSD and his own experience both as a scientist and an experimenter with drugs with the alternate stages of reality, really explore the individual's search for not only who am I, but where am I and what am I? And in A Child Born with Wings, we have a person discovering that she is not what is considered the norm. Mm-hmm. And this is at that exact point of discovery for her that we're looking into her world. And it's at the same time we have Carolyn's essay in which she is discovering and exploring that the world that she knows as reality is vastly different from the world that her students know as reality. Yeah. And then trying to make a connection with them at this level of what we consider high art through things like Hamlet, Oedipus Rex, mm-hmm. and actually being successful in a way by the end of the piece in a way that gives us hope.
Yeah.
In the notes in the back from the contributors, about the contributors, mm-hmm. you posed a question.
We like to mess up with things. We've done it every issue.
If you had a pseudonym, what would it be? Did that question arise out of this exploration of...
No. That's
part of the magic.
And then we realized, oh my goodness, we came up with these. We actually sent the contributors 4 questions. Mm-hmm. We asked them to provide us alternate titles if they were to write under a pseudonym, if, you know, they could give us the dream title for a book that they had not written, perhaps would never write, but that they would like to use. Mm-hmm. And I think the last one was, if they could retitle any famous work, what would it be? Mm-hmm. All of these, of course, having to do with naming and identity and envisioning and re-envisioning things. We just came up with this in an editorial meeting, and it sounded like fun. And this was well before the issue was completed and put together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it just fit perfectly with this overarching kind of mm-hmm. theme of identity.
Yeah.
And it was fun, too. Yeah. Some of the pseudonyms people came up with were very funny.
What was that poet? The poet's...
Daniel. And Gutstein.
Blood and Gutstein.
And
we've been doing this every issue, I should say.
Right.
I mean, and one of the reasons why is because, you know, the contributor's notes usually in a literary magazine is who's published where, who's famous, who's not, who's coming up, who, you know. But we figured, well, of course we're going to have that, right? But we wanted the contributor section to be a section where you would actually want to go and read that too. That it's actually I think it's the most entertaining contributor mm-hmm. section in all of literary magazines, because you're going to have a great time reading it. And I think people who write their contributors notes have fun contributing those little extra somethings or others. And we kind of got that idea from Michael Martone, a writer who's in our first issue, who is writing a book called Contributor's Notes, in which he writes these faux nonfiction essays about his life that kind of turn into stories, and he would publish those ask them to be published in various magazines in the contributor's notes section rather than the body of the work. And we figured, well, that's something we could do too. We could adapt that.
Yeah. And we can tell people, I can tell people this afternoon, although I won't tell them what the answer to the question is, is you can find out, you will learn how Bill Hammack became associated with engineering and life.
Right. Yeah,
that's right. That's one of the features in our Where We're At section, which is a regular column that we have in the magazine that's focused on Midwestern people, places, and things that are connected to the region.
Mm-hmm.
And that's some of those are written by our graduate students. Some of them are written by local writers.
Yeah.
And so there is an interview with Bill Hammack in there that's very interesting.
Yeah. And before we have to wrap up, maybe, Michael, you'd read another poem, maybe another poem from the Inuit woman.
Oh, I can certainly do that.
Yeah, maybe the one about the dogs and the wolves. I like that.
Too short a time with wolves. That's
the one. That's it.
Another poem by... Lucille Amarack. Too short a time with wolves. 4 new sled dogs at our home. My cousin brought them from Padley. But the next day, one was living at my uncle's house. My uncle said it had gone off with wolves, then come back and chose his home house. My father said, usually if a dog goes off with wolves, my father said, it stays away for longer, or doesn't come back at all. Well, this one was away with wolves, my uncle said, just for one night. My father said, I don't think it went off with wolves. My mother said, I don't think it went off with wolves. My other uncle said, wolves would have killed it. Wolves would have killed it. My brother said, I don't think it went off with wolves. My sister said, give him $20. Pay him for his lie. Everyone will be happy, and we can visit the dog anytime we please. That is how it turned out. But long after that, my sister said, I don't think that dog ran off with wolves.
Yeah, that's marvelous. Nice place to end. We're out of time. Will the three of you come back in December?
Oh, we'd love to.
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Very good. The ninth letter, available now, where?
At Borders, Pages for All Ages, and the Illini Union Bookstore. Also available shortly online at our website, www.ninthletter.com.
I missed that last part. Could you repeat that?
www.ninthletter.com.
Okay. And we'll put a link on our website, will.uiuc.edu.
Great.
Thank you so much. Jody, Philip, Michael, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade, where it was a wild day today. Here with the numbers, Dave Dickey.
Yes, it was indeed, Celeste, especially in that soybean pit where we saw soybeans trading over 20 cents higher on the day before backing off a little bit into the closing bell on concerns that Tropical Storm Arlene may have blown soybean rust spores north into the Corn Belt. Also, additional buying was linked to forecasts of dry conditions returning to the eastern Corn Belt this week, as well as seeing some non-commercial traders being heavy buyers today. But as we always do, let's go ahead and get you caught up on the settlements, beginning in the wheat pit, where July wheat had a high on the day of 320 and a half, a low of 313, settling 313 and three quarters, up a quarter. September, a high of 330 and a half, a low of 323 and a half, settling at 324, down a half. December wheat, a high of 342, a low of 333 and a half, settling 335 and a quarter, down a quarter. March, a high of 352, a low of 347, settling on its low, down one and a quarter on the day. July corn, a high on the day of 217, a low of 212, settling 215, up five. September, a high of 226 and a half, a low of 220 and a half, settling 224 and three quarters, up four and a half. December corn, a high of 237, a low of 233, settling 234 and three quarters, up four and a half. March, a high of 245, a low of 241, settling 242 and three quarters, up four and a half. May, a high of 248 and three quarters, a low of 246, settling 247 and three quarters, up four and three quarters. July, a high of 253, a low of 250, settling 252, up four and three quarters on the day. July oats, a high of 147 and a half, a low of 143 and a half, settling 147 and a quarter, up four and a half. September, a high of 151 and a half, a low of 149, settling 151 and a half, up four and a half. July soybeans, a high of 688, a low of 675, settling 680 and a half, up 14 and a quarter. August, a high of 690 and a half, a low of 678, settling 683, up 13 and a half. September beans, a high of 693, a low of 682 and a half, settling 687, up 16. November, a high of 699, a low of 686, settling 694 and a half, up 16 and a half. I believe a new contract high in the November contract. January, a high of 698, a low of 689, settling 693 and three quarters, up 15 and a half. March, a high of 689, a low of 680, settling 686, up 13. July soybean meal, a high of 219.30, a low of 215, settling 216.90, up 550. August, a high of 220, a low of 216, settling 217.70, up 530. July soybean oil, a high of 23.30, a low of 22.87, settling 23.01, up 27. The August contract also up 27 on the day. The high there, 23.39, the low, 22.97, and it settled 23.10. The settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where news late Friday that USDA found that a Western blot test of a previous test of a cattle of a cow for BSE, that the immuno test came up with a weak positive, And Celeste, the market reacted downward this on this day.
Yeah, feeder cattle down over $2 August, September, and October, and live cattle June and August also lower today. August feeder cattle 109.90, the high 108.35, the low, the settlement 108.47 and a half, that down 277 and a half. September 108.80, the high 107.20, the low 107.50, the settlement, that down 257 and a half. October feeder cattle 107.10, the high 105.70, the low 105.95, the settlement, that down 265. June live cattle 83.15, the high, the low 82.20, the settlement 82.30, that down 150. August live cattle 81.20, the high 80.25, the low 80.35, the settlement, that down 177 and a half. June lean hogs 67.90, the high 67.60, the low 67.72 and a half, the settlement, that up 47 and a half. July 69.40, the high 68.35, the low 68.80, the settlement, that up 47 and a half. August lean hog 68.70, the high 67.70, the low, the settlement 67.85, that down 12 and a half. October lean hogs 59.60, the high 59.05, the low, the settlement 59.50, that up 45. July bellies 70.15, the high 68, even the low 68.75, the settlement, that down 50. The Dow up 28 points at 10,541. The NASDAQ up 6 at 2069. The S&P 500 up 4 points at 1202.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Jacob Hockmeister from Burnsville, Minnesota writes, Dear Dr. Science, who is General Failure and why is he trying to read my disc?
General Failure is a man in his late 40s who woke up one morning and observed, this is about as good as it's going to get. After eating breakfast in a cheap cafe and ruminating as long as possible over a borrowed newspaper, he went back to bed to think of all the reasons he shouldn't bother to comb through the want ads. Yes, we all know a general failure or two, some of us more intimately than others, so I wouldn't take his interest in your floppy too seriously. He doesn't really give a hoot about what you've got there. He's just browsing around, surfing the web of empty promises we call life, and trying to avoid clicking on the icon marked void that dominates the center of his web page.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For information online,